that could happen to them, right? I love sales conferences because I'm a salesman, right? I know that all my jargon on Facebook, Twitter, all this stuff that we've talked about in this book isn't going to mean anything to them unless they think I'm giving them a key to unlock a sale. So when I'm talking to that kind of audience, I'm always setting up my backstory of being a salesman, right? Baseball cards, lemonade, how I sold wine in the wine shop, how I actually built a business on this hyperbole of technology, how I didn't grow up with tech, just like they didn't. So that's how I'll go there. Now, if I'm talking to 16-year-olds, I'm going to talk about, hey, listen, don't worry about the system. I was an F student. I made it okay. But then I also have empathy for the kids that are A and B students. And I talk about the upside of being a number two or a number three or things of that nature. I reverse engineer what the audience's makeup is. And then more importantly, I'm selfish for them. I don't care what I'm going to get off on stage. I want to know that they say to themselves, holy crap, this is one of the few times in my life that I've been to a talk and it brought me value. I laughed. You know, the cursing and the shtick. I always wonder, is that my natural self or am I really planning all this? Even what I'm doing with you guys, I've never been able to really unwind if this is on purpose and on strategy to create air cover for you to really learn, or is it this who I naturally am? I think I need some of my early friends to tell me. But anyway, nonetheless, that's one key thing. Who's in the audience? What's in their best interest? Next, I really focus on the day. If it's March 2017, I know what's going on in March 2017 in the business world, the macroeconomic climate, the micro trends, what's the current state of affairs of all the platforms, and I deploy all this state of the union, what I now call day trading attention, the state of the union of technology and business through the filter of who they are. Finally, it's all about the 10 minutes right before I take the stage. Somewhere around 6 or 7 minutes before, sometimes as close as 3 minutes before, a weird switch goes on. A lot of my fellow speakers or organizers are always weirded out that like 8 or 12 or 15 minutes before the talk, I'm still like, I don't know, barely dressed, like on the phone, on like dealing a business, you know, kind of how I just walked into this session. 5 seconds ago, I was dealing with a major business thing, but boom, right in here, it's prime time. So I'm all over the place right before, to the point where a lot of organizers early on in my career were nervous, now that I've got a little bit of a track record, but then somewhere around, I don't know, call it 300 to 600 seconds before I take that stage, I actually get competitive with the audience. And this is where it's weird. I actually feel like I want to fight them. For all the love and empathy and all the, it's only about them, and I'm not there to sell myself or things of that nature, I start pushing in the other direction right before I go on stage, which means that I don't want to pander to them. I'm not going to give them what everybody else gave them. I'm not worried about how they're going to accept what I'm about to deliver. I'm about to deliver it. And they're my competitor in a weird way, even though they're equally my child or my mentee. I have this interesting friction between admiration and respect and empathy to deliver them the best talk of all time. And equally, I'm going to go on stage and punch these motherfuckers in the face, right? It's this kind of really weird intensity. And I feel like I'm a boxer. I feel like I'm about to take the stage. And it's me, one person on stage versus the entire audience. And that gives me the right energy, especially with the way I mentally prepare beforehand, recognizing it's all about them.
How do you get away with so many F-bombs on stage?
The way I answered this on the show and in the book is going to be different than the way I'm about to answer it for you because, guys, day trading attention, evolving as a human. I've actually put myself in a different mindset around this question in the last 4 to 7 weeks. And here's the answer. Leo, first of all, thanks for asking these questions, internet pioneer. Leo and everybody listening, I don't. I have a fun fact that a lot of you don't know. And D-Rock right now is filming a Daily V, so I want to make sure he's paying attention because this is getting in the footage. I don't get away with F-bombs. The dirty little secret that so many of you don't know is that my agents at CAA, multiple people around me, public speaking organizations, people that organize the biggest conference in the world, have all spoken to me multiple times that if I stopped cursing, that I easily would be one of the highest paid public speakers in the world. That I would take myself to a totally different level. That I'm missing out on minimum hefty 7 figures a year in conference opportunities because the decision makers are uncomfortable with my potty mouth, and that the answer, really, Leo, is I'm not getting away with it. Now, the reason I think I'm getting away with it in a different context, meaning why are people constantly tweeting or Facebook commenting that they hate cursing but it's okay when I do it, is because I think about intent. Meaning, guys, I'm not on stage cursing because I'm doing it on purpose and I think it's helping me. As a matter of fact, and this is just black and white, I just said it, it's hurting me. I'm doing it because it's who I am. It's my natural state. It's my truth. I am a kid that grew up heavily influenced by Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, and Chris Rock. I liked it. I listened to those tapes. It's what I liked. And just like anybody, just like some of you say some of my words or market like me now, I was influenced. And for some, I mean, if you think that I knew that that's what was going to happen when I took the stage, it caught me by surprise. I don't really remember the first or second time I came off stage and I was really cursing up a storm, but I'm like, where is that coming from? But I'm always committed to being my natural self. And I think the reason I quote unquote get away with it from acceptance from a lot of people is because I think they can taste the authenticity. They can see that it's not forced. We know when people are forcing things. If I wasn't cursing, I think people can feel it. When I've been asked, and by the way, if you're listening to this and you want to hire me, I'm more than capable of doing a keynote without cursing. And when I've been asked, or the hundreds of times that I've been on television where I know I can't do it, you know, it's the 99.3% version of me, not the 101.5% version of me. And so that's just the way it is. I think I get away with it because it's my truth.
I've noticed as a speaker, you rarely use filler words and you hardly ever lose your train of thought on stage or in front of the camera. Can you provide some insight into how you've nurtured your public speaking chops?
I think when it's all said and done, my kids, when they analyze me, will realize that the things that I was good at, A, came naturally to me, and B, I put in a crap load of work. So if you really look back at my life, since 2006, when I kind of hit the scene with Wine Library TV and then public speaking, things of that nature, you know, I've put in a lot of hours. There's a lot of camera hours on YouTube. There's a lot of stage hours. So I just kept honing my skills and getting more used to it. And really, you know, even this book, this is the third time I'm doing it, so it's going to come a little more natural to me than the first time. So I kept honing and honing my skills. There's another thing that I do that I think is grossly underestimated. I'd like to be appreciated for it a little bit more, and more importantly than my own ego, I'd really like for you to listen. So please, please listen to what I'm about to say. I don't talk about things I don't know. When you talk about things that you don't understand or you don't know much about, you start hesitating. You're thinking on the spot. For me to talk about geopolitical issues or pharma concerns or how farmers are dealing with climate change is going to be a place where I will stutter and think and ponder and it won't flow. For me to talk about the thing that I live and breathe, my oxygen, the business world, the tech world, the way I rolled, entrepreneurship, empathy, self-awareness, this book, it's a piece of cake. It's all I know. It's like me asking you to tell me about yourself. You're not going to stutter. You know it. It's ingrained. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that people do on stage and in front of a camera is try to go into lanes that they don't belong in. I stay very, very narrow, but I'm very, very deep. As a matter of fact, the thank you economy, the way I talked about in this book about marketing, kind of that with depth thing, that's me as a person. When I speak, when I'm on, it's going to be about the things I'm on. And more importantly, I've developed even this recently, which is really taking my game to the next level. Early in my career, 06 through 12, 13, when I had a question I didn't really know, I'd navigate. I wouldn't put myself out there. I didn't draw a line in the sand or put a flag in the ground. I navigated. I wouldn't say I dodged it. I navigated. Recently, in the last 12 or 18 months, I've literally gone directly to, you know what? I don't know. That's not something I spend a lot of time on. It's been stunning to watch people respond to that kind of truth, that level of humility when you've got the mic and everybody's looking at you. And what it's also done is it's made everything else that I've talked about more impactful. Chapter 19, Music. In this chapter, I talk about the Numa Numa song, new revenue streams, and making your fans fall in love with you. I would have lost an enormous amount of money if a year ago you told me that I was writing a book called Ask Gary Vee, and one of the chapters was going to be about music. I would have made a bet against it for money that matters. Money that matters is something me and my brother AJ talk about all the time. When, you know, all your buddies are always betting and things of that nature, you know, you gotta actually push them to a level where they're uncomfortable so that the bet actually matters. So if you want to pick something up, you have a friend that's always betting and it doesn't really matter, get them to money that matters. That's when it's interesting. Yet, as Stephanie Land, my writer, and the rest of the team and I worked to pull together the material for the book, we discovered that I had answered a number of questions about music. Who knew? Most people who care about the art form do not respect my relationship with music. I have no musical talent, and my contemporaries often disrespect my taste. One of my favorite things to do is put a favorite song on continuous loop and listen to it for 5 to 7 hours. I once listened to Bone Thugs and Harmony's song First of the Month through the entire train trip from Boston to New York, and I didn't take the Excella. While making the final edits of this book, I listened to Drake's Back to Back on loop. But you'll also find Lionel Richie and Cyndi Lauper on my iPod. This is fun for me. I don't have amazing passion for the indie or hip-hop scene, but I'm excited to see how many musicians have real talent mixed with entrepreneurial DNA, and I'm passionate about seeing how the changing marketing and communications landscape has provided opportunity for them. Think about it. Would anybody have ever heard of Dragostea Dinti if it weren't for Gary Brosloma? You're probably thinking you still haven't heard of it, but you have. It's more commonly known in this country as the Numa Numa song. And Gary Brosloma is the guy who uploaded a home video of himself lip-syncing to it onto the internet back in 2004. The song went on to become an internationally best-selling single. And while the band who wrote it, Ozone, split up, Gary Brosloma endures and, according to his website, continues to make music and videos. Carly Rae Jepsen, whose new pop album is being called one of the best of the decade, had been writing and recording songs in Canada for several years before Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez first tweeted about her catchy song Call Me Maybe and created the famously goofy YouTube dance video to go along with it that turned her into an international star. So you know how I'm always saying that you don't want to obsess about how many followers and fans you have, but rather about who your followers and fans are, and that the quality of your content and engagement with them is everything it should be. That's why. It used to be that in order to get any attention, you had to make 1,000 demos and pray that some music producer would bother to listen and sign you up for a record deal. After which, you were at the mercy of that label. But now, aspiring musicians have far greater control over their careers and many more avenues they can take to get their music heard. They don't have to please record labels anymore. They just have to please their fans. Do you have any idea how many bands and artists have been able to break out and become profitable because they knew how to use social media like Vine and YouTube to reach their audience? These are the same bands that would have never been able to get so much as a meeting with a major label 15 years ago. For sure, there are fewer artists who go platinum, but the long tail has gotten even longer and allows a greater number of performers to make money. That's why I don't understand why so many people continue to bemoan the fate of the music industry and complain that musicians can't get a fair shake. They sure as hell can, if they hustle, that is. They just have to stop thinking of themselves as artists and start thinking of themselves as a business.
Hey guys, it's Leo from This Week in Tech again with more questions for Gary V. Since music itself doesn't create income anymore, what advice do you have for musicians wanting to make their living playing music in the 21st century?
First and foremost, if you're a musician, you have to get out of the romance of how it used to be. Like, I'm sorry that, you know, CDs and records and tapes aren't the way you make money anymore, and it was so great for the 60s and 70s and 80s. It was, but they didn't have the internet, so how great was their lives? You know, I mean, like, look, the bottom line is the romance elimination is number one. Way too many people are romantic. Number two, you have to start thinking 360. First and foremost, music lives on attention. You need people to hear it, to pick up momentum. And so if you're not really thinking about your strategy on Instagram, Snapchat, Vine, Facebook, Twitter, on and on and on, you're creating an enormous vulnerability to not be discovered. You know, you've got to play. You've got to go and play live music. You've got to create music, and you have to distribute music. I think the other thing you need to think about is your revenue streams. So, for example, a lot of influencers out there these days on Instagram, you too can. For example, one of my favorite startups I'm paying attention to right now that I'm not talking about is called Musical.ly. Why don't you have your original music on that platform and get it discovered? I was fascinated by when some songs from the 80s and 90s popped to the top of the charts because they were used in Vines last summer. So you have to get distribution. More importantly, you have to think about different ways about making your money. For example, you have to be 360 in the way of thinking about merchandising. You have to sell t-shirts and hats and sponsored posts on Instagram. You've got to make your money differently than you used to. I think about it like this. Everybody said that musicians were dead and the music industry was dead, but it's flourishing. There's more than ever. The art will never die. The way it's distributed and the way people make money has changed. It's no different than journalists. 3 or 4 years ago, everybody was talking about journalists being dead because the newspapers and magazines were in trouble. Yes, but I have 2 full-time journalists on my team now, something I would have never done because I've realized everybody's in the content business, and I think we're going through the golden era of journalism because there'll be millions of places you can write for. Now, if you're 32 and you grew up in an educated family and your dream was to write for The New Yorker, the world's changed on you. Sorry, maybe it's now BuzzFeed Politics. That's how the world works. To really create income in music, you're going to have to make it around t-shirts, live events, experiences, swag, you know, just a million different ways you may have not thought about in the past. And here's some good news. If you're great enough, Adele, you know, Taylor Swift, these kind of characters, you will make income from your music. More importantly, unlike 1960s, 70s, and 80s culture, if you weren't good enough, you had no option. You became a barber, you became a homemaker, you became a policeman, or you became a CEO, but you didn't become a musical monster. Today, the practicality of making $100,000 a year and playing your music and having that love is much more real because of all these micro income revenue streams, and you get to keep all of it instead of sharing most of it with the label and most of it with your manager. And so the rules have changed. Adjust.
As a private music teacher, I have limited hours to teach. I'd like your thoughts on how to increase my income and my brand.
Look, I have a personal full-time trainer. His name's Mike, right? He gets paid to only train me. But over the last 18 months, I've watched him build out his internet business by building his personality on YouTube and Snapchat, and by using those funnels and blogging and writing and guest blogging and all the tactics we talked about in this book, by building up more of a profile. And now he has, you know, and he has for a little while, a internet class version of what he does for me. It doesn't cost as much as it costs me because he's with me every second, but for several $100 a month, hundreds, soon to be thousands of people pay him to be trained by him via technology. That's exactly what I would do if I was a music teacher. Take the top 20% of what you're doing, charge more, have that world, and start going on YouTube and other places like that and producing content so people discover you. The other way you can do it is you can start looking at things like Skillshare and Udemy and Creative Collective and go to those places where they can sell your music course and you can share with them if you don't think you have the talent to monetize yourself. What I mean by that is Mike sells direct to people, but you could go and sell an $80 course on Skillshare and share on $40 each because that's how they split it or whatever the deal is on these platforms. There's an enormous way, better than ever. This is the greatest era to ever be alive for this kind of stuff. If you're a single practitioner, you need to become a media company. You need to take your phone and you need to start making content. You do that for 7 years and eventually you can hire a D-Rock and they can follow you around and you don't have to do it. But you can absolutely scale a $50 to $100 to $200 a month product that can teach people throughout the world. If you're massively talented and you have the dollars, you can team up with somebody who can do technology and you can create an app and sell that for $2. And that's infinite scale, right? You can have a million people paying you $2 a month for your teaching. So it comes down to your talent. First and foremost, there's talent level one. You're just good enough to teach people. You're old school, you're 70s and 80s, you don't understand. But if you're listening to this book, I think you can be talent number two, which means you've got content that you're recording and selling on the internet for scale. If you're uber talented, number three, you go for mass scale and you go for less dollars, $2-3 a month, but you build out an app or something incredible that scales infinitely.
I'm a music producer. How can I use social to promote my content?
I mean, this is kind of, you know, I really just got angry with this question. Like, I mean, like anybody else. I mean, if you're producing, you could be filming, you can live stream, you can Periscope and Meerkat while you're in sessions, you can document through Snapchat 24 hours a day your process, you can take selfies with the artists that are coming in. I mean, guys, it's the same game, whether you're picking up garbage for a living or if you're running the country, whether you're a landscaper, whether you're a baker, whether you're raising kids. I mean, do you know how many people would pay, you know, Mr. Mom $80 a month or $8,000 a month to teach them how to do it? Every profession in the world, like we talked about B2B, if you know how to produce content, you can win. And when you're a music producer, you've got a lot of people interested. And so I think the real question is, how do I motivate myself to get started, not what do I do? It's not super complicated. You can produce content all day long. I would love to understand. I mean, I don't. That's not true. I wouldn't. Millions of people would love to understand what's on your mind, Sally or Rick, as you're producing this music. You could be live streaming right now and say, oh, wait, you see what Rihanna just did there? I don't like that. This is why I'm thinking. Or you see what Ritrana just did there? She's an up-and-coming artist. She needs to do this. And so I'm just flabbergasted by people's lack of awareness that people will find everything interesting as long as you produce it and distribute it. Now, produce it and distribute it and then have a certain level of actual fans, meaning everybody can get 15 people to care. I believe the new 15 minutes of fame is everybody's got 15 fans. If what you're putting out is interesting, that's when you start getting into 1,500, 15,000, 150,000, 1.5 million.
I'm going to kill Gary for making me read this one as a diehard 49ers fan. Here it goes. I'm holding back tears and my heart is heavy because the Seahawks lost and I bet $225. That's like four Xbox games and an Arizona iced tea. I've listened to Drake, The Weeknd, and even Party Next Door, but the pain is too much. How do I cope?
I mean, the Seahawks have won a Super Bowl. You don't cope. You've won, kid. I'm 40 years old. For 32 years, I've hoped just to get to the Super Bowl, and you've won one. The audacity that you have to ask me this question about your pain after you've won a championship and have been to two Super Bowls in the last 3 years pisses me off to no end. I'm just desperate to sniff the thought of going to the Super Bowl. And so I don't have any real answer for you. As a matter of fact, I'm happy that you have pain. As a matter of fact, I want to bring you more physical pain. So come see me in New York so I can punch you in the mouth.
How would you suggest an indie artist use his or her marketing money when royalty checks come 6 months later?
You know, look, I mean, this is a cash flow game, and I get it. I would say to be patient in the first 6 months and eat, you know, noodles and sleep on a couch and get side jobs and go garage sailing and flip stuff on eBay. And I mean, there's a million, you know, get side jobs, babysit. I don't care. The thought that like, oh, woe is me. I've actually have money coming one day. It's just not here yet. What do I do for the next 6 months? I don't know. Like, travel the world for free and hitchhike. There's some kid hitchhiking right now from Vancouver to my office because he wants to be on the Ask Gary V show, and he's getting by through the kindness of people. I think a great thing to do for 6 months as a musician is to travel the world and hitchhike because you'll get new experiences and it should help you write great new music. I mean, this is a silly question. It speaks to art skills, not business skills. What you do is you wait. And then once it starts happening, you only have to wait for 6 months because then it's continuous. Then the royalties just keep on coming. And so, you know, you just should really focus on producing good enough music that royalties continue to come. I'm sure that a lot of people who create and produce music right now are pissed right now that I'm answering this because 99% of them are like, how the hell do I even get royalties, let alone wait for the next 6 months? I mean, that's a silly question. I would say enjoy yourself, chill out. I don't care, zen out, go on beach and smoke weed. I don't care what you want to do to make yourself happy. Once it starts coming is the real question, which is how do you reinvest those dollars in, for example, targeting on Facebook fans of the genre of music that you produce and taking your royalties and spending it for your future? The real question here is when you get into some money, what do you do with it? Do you triple down on your career and try to get more people to hear your music so you make more money in the future? Or do you buy a, you know, a Toyota Camry? I mean, like, you know, so that to me is a far more interesting question than what do I do for the 6 months before the money gets here? Chapter 20. Sports. In this chapter, I make a prediction about the Dalton deal. That's Andy Dalton for you non-football fans. Reveal what team I'd buy if I can't buy the New York Jets, and explain the parallels between tennis and business. Unlike music, sports are an enormous pillar of my life. It's my real passion besides business and factors into all my ambition and determination to buy the New York Jets. It's relevant, too, because over the last decade, the sports industry has become very interesting to a lot of entrepreneurs, and the landscape around it, from communications to business, has expanded and is evolving rapidly. This chapter may not have the most teeth in it, but if you want this one man's 360-degree point of view, we gotta go here. I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I enjoyed answering the questions.
Hey, it's Dunwin back with another question. What did you think of the Dalton deal?
By the way, I'm like laughing inside right now. To hear Steve Unwin Stunwin ask a sports question is really makes me happy. Thanks, Dunwin. In 2014, Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Andy Dalton signed a 6-year, $115 million contract with the Cincinnati Bengals. There was a lot to do about this, guys, for all the sport fans. Here's why. Andy Dalton's been pretty solid in the regular season in his early career, but he's completely shit the bed in the playoffs. Now, I wrote this book before the latest season ended. Here's what happened. He had a remarkable year this year. The Bengals were cruising and one of the best teams in football, and then he got hurt late in the season and didn't finish the season and didn't play in the playoffs. And as you can imagine, what happened was the Bengals tanked, and then they lost to the heated arch rivals Pittsburgh Steelers in the playoffs. And what I think it really did was allow a lot of Bengals fans to appreciate what they have in Andy Dalton. Here's what I think. There's 32 quarterbacks in the NFL. And if you're lucky enough to have one of the best 15, forget about 5, 6, 7, you're very, very lucky. As a Jets fan who only probably had his best quarterback season this year from Ryan Fitzpatrick when he was probably the 19th best quarterback or 16th best quarterback in football after a decade of 29, 31, 32 quarterback play, I get mad when people are upset, and you've got to pay the quarterback. This was a good deal. I think Andy's going to have a very good career. And the question is, what's the alternative? Too many people only look at things on face value in business. They don't think about what the alternative is. As I've grown as a businessman, I now look at opportunities, and I say the biggest mistakes I've ever made were the things that I didn't do. Right? You might have signed Dalton, but if you didn't, what were you going to do? And that's why I think it's a good deal, because there's not that many options that are better. And more importantly, there's no option that's practically better. You're not signing Tom Brady off the Patriots, guys.
Hey, guys, what's up? This is AJ, Gary's brother and co-founder in VaynerMedia. Got a few questions from the fans. I'm going to read them off right here, right now. With the NFL in London this week, what do you think about sports franchises moving to other cities or countries?
You know, it's really interesting. At the time of writing this book, this had not happened, but the St. Louis Rams NFL team has just moved from St. Louis, actually back to Los Angeles, and the San Diego Chargers look like they're going to move as well, and it brings a lot of emotion. I mean, I'm very lucky. I grew up in the New York area. Our teams don't move, but a lot of these towns, whether it's been Baltimore or Cleveland or St. Louis, they've seen their teams move, and I couldn't even imagine. I couldn't imagine the Jets moving somewhere. Now, it's a little bit different. When I was a kid growing up, if your team moved, you actually didn't even see them. Now with the world changing, the NFL ticket, things of that nature, it feels much more feasible. As a matter of fact, I've thought about what if I ever moved. One of the reasons I would never move was because of the New York Jets, not just my family. Now it feels much more feasible to move to LA or Texas or things of that nature because I can actually see every play. What I think about it is it's business. It just comes down to money, and I get it. And as a businessman, I can't begrudge it. I can't be romantic about this when I yell at everybody else for not being romantic about their thing. So I'm unemotional about it. It happens. It's real. It's all business. And I think it's interesting. What I am curious about is what city in America, like Oklahoma City, got a basketball team. What city in America is next to get a true professional team that's never had one before? To me, that's really interesting. Las Vegas pops to mind. Well, you know, when in my life am I going to see a new city emerge with one of the big four franchises? And then global. Will a team go in the NFL to London or Mexico City as it looks like they may? The NBA is enormous in China. Could we see the Beijing Bears one day? I'm excited by that, to see it evolve. It always will evolve, and it's fun to watch.
If the Jets never come up for sale in your lifetime and another NFL team does, would you buy that team instead?
No. I would not buy another NFL team. As a matter of fact, when Stephen Ross, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, bought a minority share in VaynerMedia with AJ and I, he offered us a small percentage of the Miami Dolphins. And it was a very difficult decision because I knew it would create the beginning of me being in the NFL family. And it was a lot of things that were running through my mind to justify why I should own a little piece. But I couldn't get there. If Woody Johnson sells the team tomorrow to a 37-year-old billionaire, and it's not in the cards for me to ever really get them, I would really start focusing on the New York Knicks. The Knicks would be my number two. And then after that, if the Dolans were to never sell in my lifetime, me and AJ have always had this weird joke that we would buy the Milwaukee Bucks. What's weird about that is they now have a very young owner, so I think that's out of the cards. Obviously, the one thing that's in the back of my mind is a Major League Soccer or eSports. I actually think I'm going to bet on the next UFC in my career and then make a lot of money because I'm going to buy something for $20 million that's then eventually worth $1 billion, then sell that, and then buy the Jets, even if the NFL is on a decline, because it's still my mission.
Do you see parallels between tennis and business?
I do. I like tennis a lot. It's one of the few things I still play. I'm not really good at it, especially when I started meeting other guys in the tech world. I've met a really great friend, Ryan Harwood, who's the CEO of PureWow.com, who played tennis in college. I'm like, okay, that's a very, very different level than me and my friends hacking around in the backyard. The reason I see so much in tennis specifically, and every sport's got this, what I like about tennis is it's very one-on-one, right? It's you versus one other person. And you know, I'm sorry to call you out, Nate. Nate, my former assistant, at the time when Xander was born 3 years ago, he was my assistant. And we had some downtime when Xander was born in August because I was staying home a bunch. And we were working out and we were playing tennis. And there was multiple times he had me down 5-2. And I was able to come back and win both sets. And really, really, it's because I just think that I outwilled him. It was a mentality game. And much like business, it's a long game, right? Just because you're down 5-2 doesn't mean you're out. In business, we've seen business on the cusp of going out of business, making one pivot, and then saving the day. And this happens in other sports, but it's far more unlikely that you're down 87-62 in basketball, 2 minutes left, and you come all the way back. I think about it like boxing. You could lose all 11 rounds, and then boom, one shot. Or overtime hockey. It's that moment where everything changes. Tennis has that. Tennis has you being dominated, and then one point can switch it. And I think that's much more similar to business. What's amazing about entrepreneurship is, and this is going to inspire a lot of you. Guys, even if you have not been winning for the last 20 years of trying to make this happen, you can come up with the idea. You can create the business. You can create the product that changes everything overnight. Now, it's far more likely that you were never good at it, and it's not going to happen, but you still can, and that is exciting in business and in tennis. Another thing I would say is that Mike Tyson, who I love very much, used to say, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face. It's a quote that's getting a lot of love these days as Mike's back in the lexicon. I think about tennis and business that way, in the opposite direction. Nate was up 5-2 twice and thought everything was going to come out Nate. And then he got punched in the face and he couldn't rally. This happens in business. For 20 years, things have been going great for me. Things are going really well right now. But I know I can wake up tomorrow and everything can change. One false move, one market condition that I didn't see coming, and everything can go in the other direction. Momentum. It's incredible in sports, right? It's incredible. And in business, it's true too, which is why I never rest on what I've got going on, and I'm always kind of tense and ready to go, because in the business world, much like sports, it can change on a dime. Chapter 21, Wine. In this chapter, I talk about how tech brings new voices into old industries, I make some wine recommendations, and I tell you what to drink with kimchi. You didn't think I could write this whole book and not mention wine, did you? In this one man's point of view, what has happened to wine in the last half decade since I stopped being as intimately involved with it is nothing short of transformative. So many fun things have happened. Wine has grown to become a standard in American culture. Rosé wine has finally established itself in the United States. That makes me smile quite a bit. People are trying lots of different wines. That makes me smile, too. But the thing that is really making me smile is how many new voices have emerged. I have enormous respect for Robert Parker and the Wine Spectator, the two most powerful voices that dominated the industry long before I entered the field and throughout my entire wine career. They were monumental and served a real purpose for their time. Yet, what a great evolution to see how many new voices have been able to emerge because of social media and tech. New apps where people can leave reviews, blogs, hundreds of thousands of pieces of content put out by bright new personalities in the wine community, especially on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest. It's been inspiring and exciting to be able to learn from so many different perspectives, in addition to incredible thought leaders like Jancis Robinson, Wine Spectator, and many others. As in all other sectors that provoke passion in so many, we're living in a time where we have access to better debates and more original stories, which I think allows consumers to enjoy a richer exploration of a beverage and cultural touchstone that's been around since the beginning of time and will be around when most of us are gone.
Hey, this is Charlie Ebersole, founder and CEO of the company and Gary Vaynerchuk disciple. I'll be reading the next questions in the Ask Gary V book. Thanks for listening. What wine bar or restaurant would you recommend to a first-time visitor to New York City?
Some of you may know I'm a co-founder in an app called Resy, R-E-S-Y. Please download it now. So I had to make that plug. That's a right hook if you are keeping score at home. And on that app, we have tremendous restaurants that I'm a big fan of, including Rosemary's, Minetta Tavern, Toro, Scarpetta, Carbone, Charlie Bird, Balthazar. I'm a huge fan. I'm also an enormous fan of a wine bar called Terroir, which dominates here in New York City. You should definitely check out those spots.
Tea, coffee, or wine?
The answer is water these days, unfortunately, or fortunately. I literally couldn't drink water for the first 38 years of my life. I've finally gotten there, but I'm still struggling with it. Under normal times, it would go wine, coffee, tea, which is a new phenomenon. I like tea better than coffee, but coffee is very interesting to me. By the way, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram if this is true for you as well. I actually use coffee as a comfort food now. I actually probably have 4 to 6 cups of coffee poured for me on a given day when I'm in New York City, but I may consume 3/4 of one. I just have it there as a comfort food. I actually grew up, ironically, with tea that way. In the Russian culture, you just have it a lot. But really, it's wine for me, and then a big drop off from there. Oh, and one last thing. I'm a humongous root beer fan. Unfortunately, I haven't had any root beer for the last 18 months as I have not consumed a single glass of soda since I've been on my new diet.
What wine goes with kimchi?
You know, I'm Eastern European, so I love pickled foods. High acid whites are a tremendous place to go here. I also think thick white wines. I'm a big fan of Rhone Valley white wines for this. So Roussan, Viognier, Marsan. These are the varietals that I think will go best with kimchi. I'd highly check those out.
On Fridays, we drink wine. What's a good drinking home alone bottle to yourself wine?
In the book, I gave 4 distinct recommendations. I'm not going to do that here in the audiobook to continue to mix it up. Let me say a couple things. Number one, if you want to fall in love with wine, and it's a great thing to fall in love with, as I have, the number one key is to try different things. The biggest mistake that people make is they find one wine they like and they drink it to death. Pinot Grigio, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. And I don't mean the same brand. I mean just the same varietal. So the first thing I would do is try different kinds of wines every night. Fiano, Greco di Tufo, Grenache, Petit Verdot, Chinon. There are so many wines out there, but yet we only drink 7 or 8 or 9 of them. So explore. Start a club or a system that makes you try 52 different wines on the 52 Fridays in the year. You would be stunned where your palate is and where your passion for wine is 1 year later.
When someone gives you a horrible glass of wine, how do you politely get rid of it?
You know, it's funny. I made my name as being the anti-snob, anti-establishment. So I probably got more polite with this in 2006 and on when I was a personality in the wine world than I was from, let's say, 98 to 2006 when I was fairly in it. But I always recognized that most people weren't into wine the way I was, so I shouldn't impose that snobbery on them. You know, to me, the answer is actually quite easy, and I do it all the time. I just kind of push it to the side and start doing other things and try to distract. I'm like, look, a bird over there. You know, it's like I start drinking water. I start eating foods. I change up my seed. I start to mingle. I don't think there's anything good out of like dissing somebody for a crappy glass of wine. The other thing is, I've got to admit, and this is weird, and I don't know how many people are like this, I actually don't mind a crappy glass of wine. It actually helps me appreciate good wine. Because I go to so many ball games and I'm in so many dude-type atmospheres, I've drank a lot of crappy wine in the last several years. Even on my diet, it's been the one thing that I haven't totally cut out. And I've had my fair share of crap in 2015 and early 16. I just kind of smile and move on and appreciate the context. You don't know when something's great unless you've had something that's average. And I don't mind taking the biggest upside. Listen, I'm an optimist. I take the most out of having a crappy glass of wine. But if I want to, I bob and weave.
Is the high-end wine business a complete hoax?
Yes and no. Let me explain. Anything high-end that I'm not into is a hoax. The high-end watch business is a hoax. For me to spend $5, $10, $25, $50, $100,000 on a watch, I'd literally rather rip my eyeball out of my body than buy a $10,000 watch. Yet, for my homie Kevin Rose, who runs Houdinki, or for AJ, who's now become passionate about it, or for millions of people, they love it. Cars. For me to buy a $100,000 race car to drive around on the weekends so I can rekindle my youth, or whatever people get chicks, or whatever people do that for, is a complete hoax. I don't want a Lamborghini. They stink. But for me to buy a $200 custom-made Jets jersey of a player that may play one snap in a season because he's on the practice squad is one of the great ways for me to spend $200. Because for me, when I go to a football game and real fans see me wearing it and they realize right then and there that I'm a bigger fan than they are because I've got a practice player's jersey on, that's what I want to get off. Every industry is predicated that way. Are expensive wines better, better produced, taste better than inexpensive wines? Yes. If you are unable to taste that because you don't have context, then it's no. I can look at a piece of art that's worth $1 million and throw up on myself because I don't have context or subjectiveness to why that is. So the hoax of the high-end wine business is no different than the hoax of every other thing in the world. So the hoax of high-end wine is the same hoax of everything. If you don't have context, and if you don't have passion, and if you do not have appreciation, then it's a hoax.
What's your favorite city in the world to drink wine?
Now we get to go a little bit deep. The favorite city I have for drinking wine is the city that I'm in at the time when I'm drinking it with my friends and family. The one thing I adore about wine is it brings people together. If you think about when you're having wine, it is very often in, you know, positive atmospheres. Yes, of course, you can have them in a funeral. I get it. But it's a very highly positive. You tend to be around people you want to be with. Even if you're in a business environment, it's intriguing. It brings people together. And so for me, the best glasses of wine I've ever had weren't necessarily the best wines I've had. They've just been with the best people. It was at a ball game. It was with my family. My parents and I had a dinner the other day that was incredible. Just the three of us, which was very rare and very exciting. We had a very average white wine and I loved it. It tasted delicious. And so for me, the city is always going to be the times when I'm spending it with the people I love the most.
How do you tell the difference between all the wines in the store?
Well, there's one way you don't that 93% of you do when you shop for wine, which is you look at the label and you literally make a judgment on the wine because of the label. I have good news for you. There's sneaky marketers like me that know this and play to every single psychology you could imagine to make you buy that wine, including cute pets that you love so, so much and always sell so well. I mean, look, it comes down to education, right? You are either educated and know, Or you go to a shop that has people that are educated and they start recommending. But back to a couple questions ago, 52-week regimen. Put yourself on the wine exercise, learn different things. That is absolutely the way to go. Chapter 22. The personal, the random, and the weird. In this chapter, I talk about my spirit animal, my favorite root beers, my biggest fear, and who should play me in my biopic. The Ask Gary Vee Show is supposed to offer a 360-degree perspective on how I work, live, and think. I already live my life out in the open, so I'm often a bit surprised that there are still things people don't know about me and are curious enough to ask about. But there are quite a few, as it turns out. Which is good and makes sense because, of course, there are many topics you should be paying attention to. And amid all the conventional questions about running companies, investing, branding, marketing, and general business development, there are occasionally some, unusual inquiries. We like to respect every type of question, which is how some of these oddballs made it onto the show. I'm also flattered that some people may want my opinion on these random topics. I always find it interesting to hear what's on people's minds. I hope you enjoy listening to this fun collection as much as we enjoyed putting it together.
Oddly enough, that was only 8 questions, though I promised 10. I'll add to Gary, how much do you love Charlie? And when someone asks you a question like, how do you politely do anything, are you actually capable of answering that? Have you ever done anything politely?
So this is fun. This is a curveball. I didn't even know this was coming. We're going to the next chapters, but let's answer these. I mean, this is what makes these things fun. Number one, I love Charlie a lot. Charlie is an incredibly interesting person for me, and here's why. And I'm going to go deep here. This lets me really ad-lib. Charlie Ebersole is married to a very famous man, an iconic man who was very successful. And I am hoping to be one of those men. And I've thought a lot about how would my kids turn out? How would they be hungry? How would they be motivated? How would they be polite? Would they be spoiled? And Charlie Ebersole, along with Ben Lehr and a couple of other of my friends, have shown me that even if you grow up with money and success and admiration and attention, you could be a tremendous human being if you are parented correctly. So Charlie, I love you a lot. A, because I like you, but B, because you give me absolute hope and complete conviction that I'm going to be able to, with my wife, raise amazing kids. Number two, I'm super polite, Dick.
This is Nathan Schroeder, former CEO of Jab, 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 Right Hook, and I'll be asking the next 5 questions. Legend has it, on your first date with your wife, you told her you would marry her. We want to know the details. And also, what dating advice do you have for women in their 20s?
So, Lizzie and I met on a Sunday night. Thank God the Jets won that Sunday night in the fall, because this is a true story. I would have not gone on a date because I wouldn't have been in the right mindset. So Jets, thank you so much for helping me get married. We had an incredible 4-hour dinner date on a Sunday night from 7 to 11 p.m. I pretty much fell in love right away. It was love at first sight, especially as the dinner progressed and I got to know her. And literally within the first few minutes of our date, I started talking about my ambitions in my life. Go figure. And here's how it went down. We had an incredible dinner. I still lived in New Jersey, so I drove into the city. She lived on the Upper East Side. I offered to drive her home because it was late. I dropped her off and I called her on her phone 3 minutes after I dropped her off. She's not even in her apartment yet. She's just getting out of the elevator. And my opening line was, can you believe this is it? Literally, that was my opening line. She didn't say a whole lot right away, but we continued to talk until 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And basically, we've been married ever since. So the legend is true. And that's how it kind of went down. We got married within the year of meeting each other. And if her brother wasn't getting engaged, we probably would have been married within 4 or 5 months. You just know sometimes. As far as advice for women in their 20s, I have a lot of them working for me at VaynerMedia. I watch them very carefully. I watch them as consumers. I'm as an enormously proud father of a daughter. I'm so excited about where we are in the women's movement in our society. It's progressed so much in the last half century. And what I would say is continue on the momentum. So many of the 20-year-old gals in my office are aggressive and take control and, you know, go for what you want and just be true to yourself. If you want to be passive, then do that too. I'd give you the same advice I give a 20-year-old dude. Do you. It's always the best way to go.
Does it bother your wife that you constantly spin your ring on the show?
If you watch me carefully, especially now with Daily V, I'm sure that will pop up. I love to spin my wedding ring. I just want to say this. All my type A, straight-laced buddies, you know, like really, like, organized and lists and shit, every one of them is on their third wedding ring because they've lost the other two. I am still on my original wedding ring. Lizzie, you are not, and you know it. So I am very proud for all my chaos. It's quite controlled, and I'd like to think she thinks it's cool. I'm not sure. I'll ask her tonight.
How do I get the cute old lady who keeps accidentally calling my house to stop? I just want a nap.
So first of all, I remember this question very well. If you've called her cute, you're a good guy or gal, right? Like, you're obviously a nice person. And so I actually think you reverse the script. I actually think the next time she calls, you engage in a full-length conversation and get to know her. You could even become friends. I think a fun thing would do instead of saying wrong number and hanging up is to actually say, hey, you've called me several times, but before you go, what's your name? Who are you? Who are you trying to reach? Tell me about yourself. I'm very into trying to force serendipity. It's a kind of this interesting thing I think a lot about, which is serendipity is clearly natural and happens. But what happens when you try to force it? What happens when you try to do things like that? What happens when you deploy sunshine and rainbows and optimism to the world and kindness and nice things and things that movies are made of? I'll tell you what happens because I live it. Nice things happen. A lot of times nothing happens. You know, she's like, what are you talking about? Sorry, I was trying to call my sister. I'll never call again. Other times you get into a great conversation and you meet one of the nicest people and best people and you show up to her funeral 5 years later and it's very emotional. It's quite sad. And then you write a book about it, make millions. And then, I mean, there's a million things that can happen. Clearly my head went to business. I'm sorry for like, I'm so sorry, everyone, that I had to go there because it ruined the whole damn thing. Maybe you forget about writing the book and making millions. Maybe you do it and then the world and the universe 60 years later does it for you when maybe you're lonely and your grandkids don't call anymore. And maybe you call somebody randomly by accident and maybe you get a friend. I just believe in that karma shit.
Why is your phone always in the shot?
Well, because my phone is the actual extension of me as a human being. If you have not figured out that phones are the future of us being robots, you're lost. Most of you are literally within arm's reach of your phone at all times. I don't like keeping my phone in my pocket if I don't have to, so when I'm sitting and doing the show on my table, I put my phone down. That's why.
Hi, this is Matt DeMeo. I'm Gary's assistant, and I'll be reading the next 5 questions. Cake or pie?
I don't eat either much anymore, which really sucks, but I've come to realize I'm a huge pie guy. You know, I love pie. Blueberry's really good. I went through a huge apple phase from 1992 to 1996. Was never really a big peach guy. Had a few seconds with pecan. What else is there? I love blueberry. Cherry had me for like a week once in like 2002, but that was it. Oh, rhubarb. That stuff is legit. I'm all about that. Oh, and pumpkin. I obsess over pumpkin pie. Mike, I know you're listening. I could eat a shitload of pumpkin pie, so please keep an eye on me.
Center or edge?
Edge. Edge. I think everybody plays in the center. I think the center is boring. I think school teaches you to be in the center. I think the world is based on the center. And I think the people that most win, and by the way, pay attention, most lose are on the edges. I love the edges. That's just where I live.
What is your favorite pair of sneakers of all time?
The 1985 Patrick Ewing Adidas. I'm a huge, huge Pat Ewing fan. He was my Knicks in that prime young youth. I think he's super underrated. He never had the support. I love John Starks and Anthony Mason and Charles Oakley as much as the next guy. X-Man Xavier McDaniel, let's call it what it is. These were very average guys. He never really had a number two. I wore those proudly in my Beastie Boys Run DMC days. I thought it was cool. I hated the Bulls because I was a Knicks fan. There were no Jordans on my feet. So that's it.
What is your favorite holiday tradition?
Hands down, it's Thanksgiving. It's always at my parents in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. The whole family gets together. It's just a blast. I really enjoy it. Everybody's really kind of mellow because we've got a four-day weekend. It's kind of nice. Historically, through my 20s and early 30s, I had the pressure of the fourth quarter coming up because we were in retail. That was big wine time. So there was a little bit of that pressure. Now that I'm a little bit more in a corporate America world where things wind down a little bit, there's only a couple weeks after that, I'm quite festive. I got the kids now. But being my parents sleeping over for those two or three days, my in-laws come. We've been able to keep the group together. It's been a lot of fun. I really, really, really enjoy it.
My husband is a big picture kind of guy, but so is his wish list. Any advice on Christmas shopping for this type?
I do. And ironically, when I said this on the show, my amazing wife was paying attention, and then she executed on what I said. On the show, I said, it's all about one-of-a-kind items, right? Trips, events, surprise parties, handmade one-of-a-kind things, or game-worn, like things that are one-of-a-kind. One-of-a-kind. I think that's really a big deal for people like this. I said that the number one thing that I could get in my life, and this is super narcissistic, I wanted a video of everybody I knew telling me how great I was. And for my 40th birthday in November, my wife delivered. D-Rock, ironically, is filming right now, and it's good to see him. He edited it. I literally had 2.5 hours of tons of people telling me I was the best, and it was the best movie I've ever watched. Recording history is really interesting. Yes, I loved it for my own ego and things of that nature, but I wish I had one from 10 years ago to see how everybody changed and things of that nature. With the way technology is now, really think about documenting things as gifts. I think, for example, I would love for my birthday to really have my kids do something every year that I could watch them grow up and do. Like those kind of things, you know, those picture lapses and things of that nature. With video, it's so incredible now. Really think about that. That just matters so much more than a car or a watch.
If you could clone yourself, would you?
This was the all-time incident of the Ask Gary Vee show. I'll never forget D-Rock going crazy when I answered this because I said yes, and then I talked about my clone spending time with my family while I worked, which then became this huge debate in my community that maybe I didn't love my family and that I slipped and it really proved that I cared about my work more. It was intense. But the answer is absolutely. My biggest problem in my life is my work-life balance. As somebody who's so passionate about what he does, I struggle with balancing my own ambition and my own wants and needs with the fact that I equally have my own wants and needs around spending time with my family, and I continue to hack, and it will forever be the battle. I will never win this game. Nobody ever wins this game. It's a constant struggle. The thought that I would be able to clone myself, and I would be able to spend time with my family, and I would be able to have my clone operate my businesses makes me smile.
Hey everyone, this is South Africa's very own DJ Black Coffee, and I'll be reading the next few questions for the Ask Gary Vee book. Thanks for having me. Do you wish you had done more or focused more on just one thing when you were in your mid-20s?
If you are a fan of music, especially in the up-and-coming EDM space, and what I mean by that is the evolution of it, Black Coffee is a DJ you need to pay attention to. I'm super pumped that a lot of you are hearing his name for the first time because of my book, because I'm going to be ultra cool with you in 36 months. I did, actually. I only focused on one thing, Wine Library, in my mid-20s. As a matter of fact, not only professionally, in life. I punted my personal life. I didn't hook up with chicks. I didn't go to dates. I didn't go to concerts. I didn't go to sporting events, even sporting events. I was full, all in, 24/7, 365 on Wine Library. That was my focus. That's what I cared about. And it made a huge impact. It created a base for my entire life. And really, if I could do it again, I would. Because what you realize as you get older is life is long. You know, like, in your 20s, you just don't realize that here I am as a 40-year-old man, and I know I have 40, 50, big-time years still left. That's a long time. That's my entire life. And so I did, and I recommend it, and I also recommend doing it a different way. You just have to know yourself. This is back to self-awareness. Some of you need to try a lot of different things. For me, it was to build a building block on top of the building block that my dad had created to really create the next chapters of my life, and I'm happy with the way I did it.
In the past 5 years, what's the hardest thing you've had to deal with, whether it's business or personal, and how did you get through it?
Once again, very blessed. The last 5 years have not created the adversity that I'm most worried about, which is the health and well-being of my family. Unfortunately, in the last 5 years, Lizzie lost both her grandmothers, but they were both well into their 90s and did an incredible job. And so I've just been very blessed. And so the only adversity I've really had was in business. This is very lightweight. This is called champagne problems. Getting out of the routine of doing Wine Library TV and Daily Grape was quite a challenge, believe it or not. You kind of get on a bike and you never get off. It's kind of like if I ever pivoted from being a personality and putting out content, if I just wanted to go insular, that'd be hard. Once you get into a rhythm, it's super hard to break it. And that was quite tough for me to get refocused and actually run a business like VaynerMedia. Was that